morning to open with me to Genesis chapter 45. Our sermon text this morning will come from Genesis 45, verses 25 through the 12th verse of Genesis 47. Again, we'll be reading Genesis 45, picking up in the 25th verse of Genesis 45, and reading all the way through verse 12 of Genesis 47. People of God, once again, this is the word of the living God. So give heed and hear the word of the Lord. Then they went up out of Egypt and came to the land of Canaan to Jacob their father. And they told him, saying, Joseph is still alive, and he is governor over all the land of Egypt. And Jacob's heart stood still, because he did not believe them. But when they told him all the words which Joseph had said to them, and when he saw the carts which Joseph had sent to carry him, the spirit of Jacob their father revived. Then Israel said, It is enough. Joseph my son is still alive. I will go and see him before I die. So Israel took his journey with all that he had and came to Beersheba and offered sacrifices to the God of his father Isaac. Then God spoke to Israel in the visions of the night and said, Jacob, Jacob. And he said, Here I am. So he said, I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down with you to Egypt, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes. Then Jacob arose from Beersheba. And the sons of Israel carried their father Jacob, their little ones, and their wives in the carts which Pharaoh had sent to carry them. So they took their livestock and their goods, which they had acquired in the land of Canaan, and went to Egypt, Jacob and all his descendants with him, his sons and his sons' sons, his daughters and his sons' daughters, and all his descendants he brought with him to Egypt. Now these were the names of the children of Israel, Jacob and his sons who went to Egypt. Reuben was Jacob's firstborn. The sons of Reuben were Hanok, Palu, Hezron, and Carmi. The sons of Simeon were Jemuel, Jamin, Ohad, Jachin, Zohar, and Shaul, the son of a Canaanite woman. The sons of Levi were Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. The sons of Judah were Onan, Shelah, Perez, and Zerah. But and Onan died in the land of Canaan. The sons of Perez were Hezron and Hamul. The sons of Issachar were Tola, Puva, Job, and Shimron. The sons of Zebulun were Sered, Elon, and Jalil. These were the sons of Leah, whom she bore to Jacob in Padan Aram with his daughter Dinah. All the persons, his sons and his daughters, were 33. The sons of Gad were Ziphion, Haggai, Shuni, Esbon, Eri, Erodi, and Areli. The sons of Asher were Jimnah, Ishua, Isui, Beriah, and Sarah, their sister. And the sons of Beriah were Heber and Malkiel. These were the sons of Zilpah, whom Laban gave to Leah his daughter, and these she bore to Jacob, 16 persons. The sons of Rachel, Jacob's wife, were Joseph and Benjamin. And to Joseph in the land of Egypt were born Manasseh and Ephraim, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipharah, priest of On, bore to him. The sons of Benjamin were Bela, Becher, Ashbel, Gera, Naaman, Ehi, Rosh, Mupim, Hupim, and Ard. These were the sons of Rachel who were born to Jacob, 14 persons in all. The son of Dan was Hushim. The sons of Naphtali were Jaziel, Guni, Jezer, and Shillem. These were the sons of Bilhah, whom Laban gave to Rachel his daughter. And she bore these to Jacob, 7 persons in all. All the persons who went with Jacob to Egypt, who came from his body, besides Jacob's sons' wives, were 66 persons in all. And the sons of Joseph who were born to him in Egypt were 2 persons. All the persons of the house of Jacob who went to Egypt were 70. Then he sent Judah before him to Joseph, to point out before him the way to Goshen. And they came to the land of Goshen. So Joseph made ready his chariot and went up to Goshen to meet his father Israel. And he presented himself to him, and fell on his neck, and wept on his neck a good while. And Israel said to Joseph, "Now let me die, since I have seen your face, because you are still alive." Then Joseph said to his brothers and to his father's household, "I will go up and tell Pharaoh, and say to him, 'My brothers and those of my father's house, who are in the land of Canaan, have come to me. And the men are shepherds, for their occupation has been to feed livestock. And they have brought their flocks, their herds, and all that they have.' So it shall be when Pharaoh calls you and says, 'What is your occupation?' that you shall say, 'Your servant's occupation has been with livestock from our youth even till now, both we and also our fathers, that you may dwell in the land of Goshen. For every shepherd is an abomination to the Egyptians.'" Then Joseph went and told Pharaoh and said, "My father and my brothers, their flocks and their herds and all that they possess have come from the land of Canaan, and indeed they are in the land of Goshen." And he took five men from among his brothers and presented them to Pharaoh. Then Pharaoh said to his brothers, "What is your occupation?" And they said to Pharaoh, "Your servants are shepherds, both we and also our fathers." And they said to Pharaoh, "We have come to dwell in the land, because your servants have no pasture for their flocks, for the famine is severe in the land of Canaan. Now therefore, please let your servants dwell in the land of Goshen." Then Pharaoh spoke to Joseph, saying, "Your father and your brothers have come to you. The land of Egypt is before you. Have your father and brothers dwell in the best of the land. Let them dwell in the land of Goshen. And if you know any competent men among them, then make them chief herdsmen over my livestock." Then Joseph brought in his father Jacob and set him before Pharaoh. And Jacob blessed Pharaoh. Pharaoh said to Jacob, "How old are you?" And Jacob said to Pharaoh, "The days of the years of my pilgrimage are 130 years. Few and evil have been the days of my life, and they have not attained to the days of the years of the life of my fathers and the days of their pilgrimage." So Jacob blessed Pharaoh and went out from before Pharaoh. And Joseph situated his brothers, his father and his brothers, and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramesses, as Pharaoh had commanded. Then Joseph provided his father and his brothers and all his father's household with bread according to the number in their families. And thus far the reading of God's holy word this morning. Grass withers and the flower fades, but the word of the Lord is forever. Well, as we come to the text this morning, it is often good to be reminded about the fact that what we've been reading here in Genesis, all of the things we've seen since Genesis chapter 1 and in the Joseph narrative, aren't in a vacuum. They weren't written in a vacuum. We're not to read these as though we're just chronologically following along with the people who are unfolding before us, even though that's certainly a portion and part of what we're doing. But we have to remember that there is a greater context here. In other words, to whom is Genesis written? It's certainly written for us all of these thousands of years later, but it was written to a particular people group, a people group that we read about in Deuteronomy chapter 31, a group of people standing at the brink, at the edge of the land of promise, being commanded by God to go in and to take possession of that land, to not be afraid, but to be of good courage, to trust that the presence of the Lord would go with them as they went into that land and lead them on into victory, to take possession of the land that he had promised all the way back in Genesis chapter 12. It's that context that helps us to have an understanding of what's happening here in Genesis chapter 45 and all the way through those 12 verses of Genesis 47. Because the people of God, as they're standing there on the edge of the land of promise, as they're about to begin the conquest of that land, have a reason to be instructed to take courage. They're about to go into battle against various cities. They're about to face formidable foes. And we can imagine then that it would be a little bit scary. I can't imagine that we ourselves, if we were in their shoes, would be jumping for joy at the prospect of hand-to-hand battle with swords and with spears. I highly doubt all of us are going to volunteer for that type of duty anytime soon. So we can understand why it was that they would need to be encouraged, why God would need to say to them, "Don't be afraid. I will go with you. I will go before you." and so thus faithfully obey my commandment. And one thing in the way in which God operates is that he gives his word as a means by which his people can be encouraged. He gives it to them directly in Deuteronomy 31, but he had already given them a whole book demonstrating the truth of the promise that he's giving to them as they're standing ready to overtake the land of Canaan. He says to them in Deuteronomy 31, I will be with you. My presence will be with you. I will go before you. And if you're an Israelite familiar at all with the book of Genesis, that phraseology should actually mean something because we just read it. Because God had already made this promise over and over again in the history of the people of God. And he makes it to Jacob here. As Jacob, with that same sort of fears about ready to go down into Egypt, God comes to him and he tells him, I will be with you. I will go before you. I will ensure that not only will you go down to Egypt, but also that you will come back up again. So that Jacob be encouraged to go ahead and trusting in his God's presence to then go into Egypt and trust the providential will of God to accomplish his purpose. Jacob and the children of Israel needed to remember something, that God had promised his presence. And in the remembering of that promise, and especially for the people of Israel of that post-wilderness generation, remembering that God had made this promise and fulfilled this promise before, so that they then could courageously, in light of trusting in his promise, seeing through both his provision and his preservation, live the life of faith as they took possession of that land. And that's the same thing that we are to learn from the text we've read this morning. That the people of God, trusting in his promise of his presence, seeing through his provision and his preservation, are to then courageously live the life of faith that we've been called to. We'll examine that theme along the following lines. First, we'll look at that idea of trusting in the Lord's presence. Secondly, we'll look at trusting the promise of God's presence through his provision. And then finally, we'll look at trusting God's presence through his preservation. Turning then to that first element of our text this morning, trusting in the Lord's presence. We're told in chapter 45 that Jacob, once he hears that his son is alive, after all of these many years, over a decade by now, when he hears that his son is alive, purposes in his heart that he is going to go and he's going to see his son before he dies. That's what he says in the last verse of 45. I will go and see him before he dies. And so Israel begins his journey. He's in Hebron, which would be a little bit to the north, quite a bit to the north of where Joseph is in Egypt. And so he begins his journey, and as he begins his journey, eventually he comes to Beersheba, a place that many of you should be familiar with if you remember at all the previous sermons that we've had, a place where Abraham makes a covenant, right, with Abimelech to not be at war with one another, and there calls upon the name of the Lord and offers up sacrifice to the Lord. It's a place with significance. It's a place of God's presence, a place for worshiping God. And so Jacob, as he's passing on his way down into Egypt, stops there at Beersheba and does what his fathers had done before him, offers up his worship to his God as he sacrifices there in verse 1 of chapter 46. And as has often been the case for Jacob, here in one of these pivotal moments in his life, the Lord appears to him. But he appears to him for a particular reason. He appears to him to tell Jacob, to assure Jacob, that he need not be afraid, that he need not be fearful as he makes his way down into Egypt. And that's certainly something that should be understandable, because there's really every human reason for Jacob to fear here. You got to remember, how old is Jacob here? How old does he tell Pharaoh that he is? He's 130 years old. 130 years to traverse all the way from Hebron down into Egypt, which is no small journey. to traverse those miles that lay before him at 130 years old, not riding in a car or flying in a plane, but going across the land, being surrounded by the elements with all of the dangers and the threats that would have been present for anyone making that sort of journey, then you can imagine a 130-year-old man coming to the end of his days might be a little trepidatious about making this long of a journey. And perhaps he's there at Beersheba and he's rethinking after the miles that he's taken already, rethinking whether or not he'll go down into Egypt. And beyond that, he's going to a land that he's really never been, not for any significant period of time. He's going to a foreign land with foreign people that he doesn't know. It's unfamiliar territory. And I can imagine a lot of us here have that same sort of trepidation when it goes to visiting new places, places that we've never been. I remember as a little child, when I was 10 years old, my dad moved from his first church to his second one, and I had a little bit of trepidation about going from the comfortable familiarity of where I lived to a whole new place to begin living there, making new friends. That's the same idea here. It's still a foreign land, even though he knows his son is there. There's still something unknown that lies before him. And so whatever the reason for the fear that Jacob might have, the Lord comes to him to comfort him, to offer his promise in order that he might not be fearful, but rather bold in his traversing to meet his son and to see him again. And the way in which God comforts Jacob and the way in which he assuages that fear is through the promise of his presence. We find that in verse 3. So he said, "I am God, the God of your father. Do not fear to go down to Egypt, for I will make of you a great nation there. I will go down to Egypt with you, and I will also surely bring you up again. And Joseph will put his hand on your eyes." So the Lord appears to him in the vision and he offers him comfort and encouragement to strengthen him for the journey. And the comfort and the encouragement that he offers him is his very presence itself, to provide for him, to preserve him in fulfillment of the promise that he had made to Abraham. You'll notice that in verse 3, "For I will make of you a great nation there." Familiar language. This is the carrying across of the covenantal promise to Abraham all the way in Genesis chapter 12, and then made again to Isaac and made to Jacob earlier. "Don't be afraid. I am working out my purpose. I am being faithful to carry out my promise, and I will be present to ensure that the promise that I have made to you, the promise that I have made to your fathers, will come to pass, will come to fruition. So don't be afraid. I will be with you. My presence will be with you." And that's a promise that has been reiterated to the people of God for generations since, throughout the ages. As we've already seen, Deuteronomy 31, 400 plus years after this promise to Jacob, God once again makes this promise of his presence to his people. "Don't be afraid. Be of good courage. Go into the land. Take possession of it." Why? "Because I will be with you. I will go before you. I will ensure you're taking possession of the land." Think again of the words of Jesus in Matthew 28 as he's getting ready to ascend into heaven, as he leaves his disciples to go and to carry his gospel into the world. And what does he promise them? He says, "Do this thing, and I will be with you always, even to the end of the age." They're about to go into the world and to spread the gospel, places that they've never even seen before. Quite a monumental task, and certainly one that would probably strike fear into a lot of our hearts. To strengthen them for that task, the Lord promises his presence. And we see it in Hebrews chapter 13, which is actually reiterating the promise of Deuteronomy 31, as the writer, the author of the Hebrews, is encouraging the people of God there to continue steadfast in the faith based on what Jesus Christ has done. And once again, he says to them that, "I have promised I will never leave you, nor will I forsake you." God has promised, is promising, will continue to promise his presence among his people to ensure the fulfillment of his purpose. And so then we, as the people of God, living the life of faith, whatever it is that the Lord has before us, are to be laying hold of that promise of his presence, trusting in God's faithfulness to ensure that his purpose will be fulfilled. But there's something about God's presence that we need to understand. We need to have a right understanding of God's presence. Because there are not a few people who lack a sense of what they would think is the presence of God. They wonder where God is. Believers who wonder where God is. Where's that sense of his presence? And a lot of that comes from the reality that we don't actually pay attention to what Scripture says about the nature of God's presence among his people. It's not a bodily presence. It's not a corporal presence as fleshly, tangible as we are sitting here. It's not even often and always a sensible presence, but rather his presence is apprehended both in what he says and in what he does, in his mighty acts. Here in our text, his acts of provision, his acts of preservation for the people of God getting ready to head into the land of promise. It's through the victory that he will provide for them. It is in what he does that his presence is apprehended. And we need to understand then that our intimate apprehension of his presence comes through seeing the evidence of his presence and what he does in faithful fulfillment of his word. The error in our thinking is not in our desire to experience his presence. That's a good and that's a right thing to desire. In the consummation, as the promise of Scripture says, that we shall all know as we are known. We will dwell in the very presence of God. We'll see his glory. We'll be there in that land that he provides for us. But we're not there yet. It's right to have that desire, but we're not there yet. Rather, the error in our thinking oftentimes is expecting the full realization of his presence on this side of glory and missing the evidence of his presence in our daily lives. Right? The people of God standing there at that edge of the land of promise, recipients of the same promise as Jacob, were to think back on their history, to think back on their lineage, to see God actually faithfully carrying through his promise of his presence, through the things that he did, through the way that he provided for and preserved and upheld and sustained his people all these many years. And then seeing what he did, trust in his presence through what he did, that he would be for them as he was for Joseph, as he was for Jacob, and to trust and to conquer, to live in faithful obedience. Would we grow in our apprehension of his promise? Would it be more to us than just the bare words before us? We need to trust his word and his promise. We need to respond to that promise in faithful obedience, but most importantly, what we need to learn to do is to deliberately and conscientiously consider his faithfulness and see his presence and what he does for us each and every day. Do you want to know if God is there? Then see him in what he does daily. And then trust in his presence. Well, our text reveals to us that there are more than this, but our text has two ways in which God's presence is demonstrated to his people. And that is through his provision and his preservation. And his provision is the first one that we come across in our text this morning. You'll notice that when he says, "I will go down to Egypt with you, Jacob," he doesn't give him a theophany. The angel of the Lord doesn't take on human flesh and walk alongside Jacob along the journey and stay with him there in Israel. Rather, what you see unfolding before you is the presence of God demonstrated in his provision and his caretaking for Jacob and his family as they faithfully and courageously follow the promise of God going down into Egypt. That's God's promise to Jacob. I will go with you and I will bring you up again. And that's manifested in his providing for Jacob and his family what they would need in order to survive the journey and also to prosper in the land of their sojourning. It's already been seen in Joseph, right? We've watched Joseph in the terrible circumstances that his brother had placed him in. We've already seen the presence of God with Joseph. The text tells us over and over again as he's there in Pharaoh and Potiphar's house, as he's there in prison, what? And the Lord was with him and made him to prosper. He provided for Joseph. We've already seen that with Joseph himself. And it's seen for us in what Pharaoh sends on the way with Joseph's brothers to ensure that they're able to make the journey down. You can find that in verses 21 and 23 of chapter 45. He's already providing for Jacob and his family before ever the journey begins. And it's seen again in what they're able to take with them. They're able to take all of their livestock, the totality of what they have, put them in the carts provided by Pharaoh, and begin the journey all the way to that land of promise. And it'll be seen again in what Pharaoh and Joseph provide upon their arrival there in Egypt and in their flourishing. Verses 11 and 12 of chapter 47, tell us, "And Joseph situated his father and his brothers and gave them a possession in the land of Egypt, in the best of the land, in the land of Ramses, as Pharaoh had commanded. And Joseph provided his father, his brothers, and all his father's household with bread according to the number of their families." They have everything that they need in order to dwell there in Egypt. They had everything that they needed in order to arrive there in Egypt. And they will continue to have everything they need in their sojourn in Egypt. We're told in the latter part of chapter of Genesis 47, verse 27, "So Israel dwelt in the land of Egypt in the country of Goshen, and they had possessions there and grew and multiplied exceedingly." God is faithful to his promise in providing for Jacob, for his sons, and for the people of God as they grow and as they expand. And the reason that he is faithful to his promise is because he's promised. And that faithfulness is the very evidence of his presence there with Jacob and his presence with the people of God. And the presence of God is still manifested in this way, of God supplying our needs to strengthen and to sustain us during our time of sojourning here in this world is still evidence of his presence. Think about Hebrews 13, chapter 5, or 13 and verse 5. What does the author say there? He says to the Hebrew, to the people that he's writing that letter to, he says to them, "Don't have a love for money, but rather learn to be content with what you have." What's the basis of their contentment supposed to be? The promise of God and his presence. "For I will never leave you, nor will I forsake you." Their contentment, their ability to be content in whatever state that they are in, whether it's through riches or whether it's through little, is the presence of God. That he will be there, caring for them, sustaining them, supplying their need, giving them contentment. And that promise continues to be with us as we are on our journey to that final promised land. There's something that we need to understand about our text. Yes, the provision for Jacob and his family here is set forth in physical terms. And that makes sense because he's about ready to go on a physical trip, right? A very long physical trip. So we can expect God's provision for Jacob to be in those physical terms, to give him all of the stuff that he needs to make it on the way, to make it through the journey. And of course, the provision given to him and to his family there in Egypt is a physical provision. In order for them to grow and to flourish, they need to not die in the famine. That's the whole point of the Joseph narrative, is so that the people of God and the promise of God won't be terminated because they die in the famine. And God's deliverance is to provide abundantly for his people rather than perishing in the famine. They would then be fruitful. They would multiply. They would grow. They would be preserved and protected and provided for. And so the provision of God and the presence of God in his provision is seen in our text in those physical terms. But we can't fall into the trap of seeing provision exclusively in the sense of abundant physical possession. Remember that the Old Testament is typological. And the antitype is far more holistic, far more full-orbed. God's presence through his provision is manifested in his supplying us with everything we need, with the physical, with the spiritual, and so on, to sustain us in our sojourning. It doesn't exclude the physical, but it is not exclusively the physical. Jacob needed that physical provision for the physical journey, but at its heart, that provision met a much deeper need. The confidence, the strength to make the journey, to have joy in the journey, to trust that God would provide. The Philippians chapter 4 provides us with a wonderful example of just this truth. And what's happening there in those verses that we read, Philippians 4 verses 10 through 20? Paul is thanking the Philippians for what they have sent to him, the gifts that they have given that have sustained him and helped him to carry on. Physical things indeed. But it's interesting that as he tells them that he's thankful for the things that he gives, that they have given him, he says that he didn't need his needs met that way. And the question to all of us should be, well, why not? Because he had learned to be content in all of his circumstances, for God provided him with everything that he needed in all of his circumstances. It's why he can say that whether I have much or I have little, whether I'm full, whether I'm hungry, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. He can trust that his God's presence is with him, that his Christ will strengthen him and provide anything that he would need in order to fulfill his calling. And Hebrews 13, chapter 5, confirms and grounds that reality. That God's presence is manifested in his provision to us. Yes, in the physical things, give us this day our daily bread, but in so much more. The ability to have joy, even in the midst of trial and suffering. The ability to be content, even when we don't have abundance. The ability to be strong and courageous when what is set before us is hard and it's difficult and it's terrifying. God has promised his presence through his provision of everything that we need to do what he's called us to do. Would you apprehend the presence of God, saints? Then see it in his provision each and every day. And thirdly, this morning, people of God are to learn to trust that promise of God's presence through his preservation. In the Joseph narrative, God's preserving presence through deliverance from the famine is on display throughout. We understand that. We've already seen that. Joseph was sent into Egypt in order that through the instrumentality of his rise to that position of rule, that he would be able to save many people alive, to preserve for the people of God a posterity, a remnant. We already saw that at the end of our text from last week. So I'm not going to say much about that. But there's another way in which he is going to preserve his people, his presence among his people seen in the preservation of his people, right? Is that once they come into Egypt, he's going to place them there in the land of Goshen. His presence is going to sustain them there, to grow them there. So that 430 years later, when they come out on the other side of their sojourn in Egypt, even under the oppressive hand of slavery, they go from 70 to 600,000. God's presence preserving and growing his people, ensuring that his covenant community would grow, would come up out of Egypt, and would make their way to that promised land. That's not dissimilar from the promise of Christ, is it? To the old covenant people of God, to the people of Israel there in Egypt, God is preserving them and growing them into a great nation. And Jesus says to his disciples, we've already seen that in Matthew, what does he say to them? I will build my church, and the gates of Hades will not prevail against it. God's presence among his old covenant people to grow them from that 70 to that 600,000 to begin the traverse up out of Egypt. Jesus Christ building his church until its numbers are greater than the sands of the sea. God's presence seen in his preservation and expansion of his people. But there's another way in which his preserving presence is seen here in our text this morning that oftentimes, perhaps if ever, we don't really notice. Have you ever wondered when you're reading this, and hopefully you're reading God's word and you've come across this before, have you ever wondered what the deal with Goshen is? The way that that plays out? It seems kind of weird. Jacob gets there with his brothers, with all their families. Joseph meets them, and he says this to them. He says, hey, whenever you go in front of Pharaoh, you need to tell him that you're shepherds and ask for the land of Goshen. Seems kind of out of place, doesn't it? Why? And indeed, that's exactly what his brothers do. His brothers go before Pharaoh, they tell them they're shepherds, they ask for the land of Goshen, and Pharaoh grants them the land of Goshen. But why? Why is it that Joseph puts this idea in his brothers' minds, takes advantage of the Egyptian antipathy towards shepherds to have that land of Goshen? Why is it that he instructs his brothers to angle for that dwelling in the land of Goshen when they stand before Pharaoh? And the answer is simple, is that God's preservation is also demonstrated through the principle of separation. Now, I need to be clear here. Right? The principle of separation is not that we are to be utterly separate from the inhabitants of the land of our sojourn. After all, Joseph's brothers will tend Pharaoh's flocks, and the people of Israel will serve the Egyptians as slaves. They're not going to be utterly separated from the Egyptians as though they're not to be a blessing to the people that are among. That would be contrary to what we've already seen God say that he will turn his people into. They'll be blessed and they'll be a blessing to the nations. The principle of separation isn't this utterly separate divide that keeps us from being amongst the people of the world around us. Rather, the principle of separation is being in the world but not of the world. It's the difference between sojourning in Egypt, sojourning is traveling, and dwelling in Egypt. The people of God would sojourn there in that land. They would be there temporarily. They would not dwell there. Rather, they would dwell in the land of Goshen. And why is that? Because the covenant family needed to be preserved as the covenant family while dwelling in a holy pagan nation. In order for the people of God to come up out of Egypt as the people of God, they needed to be preserved as the people of God, as opposed to being assimilated into and swallowed up by Egypt, till there would be no distinct community there, till there would be no people of God to come up out of Egypt and head to the land of promise. Because that's always the present threat, that God's people would be swallowed up and assimilated into and made part of the darker world around them. That's why there's the constant instruction to the people of God not to participate in the things of Canaan, lest they become like the Canaanites and the land would vomit them out, just like it vomited out the inhabitants of the land before them. It's why Abraham and Isaac don't want their sons to take wives from among the Canaanites, lest they become like them, which we see with Judah and with Judah's sons. The threat being of dwelling in the land versus sojourning in it is the threat of being lost as that distinct covenant community. And God's presence is seen in preserving his people as his people in preparation from bringing them up out of their sojourn there in Egypt. because ultimately the promise is lost if the people of God are absorbed into Egypt, if they're intermixed with them, if they adopt their pagan culture, their worship, their worldview. God preserves his people by giving them that land of Goshen to dwell in so that they can remain intact, able to endure that sojourn in Egypt until they return to the promised land. 17 years for Jacob before he's buried there in the land of promise, and 400 for the Israelites. In other words, God's presence is seen in the land where they dwelt and in their community as the people of God. His preserving presence is seen in providing a common dwelling where their distinct identity as a distinct people of God remains intact. Remember the promise. I will go down with you and I will bring you back again. And Goshen is the means to this end. It is in Goshen where the Israelites will still be dwelling there in Exodus, and it is from Goshen where they will go up. The question is, what do we do with that truth for us in the text? The first thing that we have to understand, right, is that, well, the church is Goshen, saints. It's the dwelling place of the people of God in our sojourn to our permanent dwelling. It's a chief means of our preservation and a chief means that God's presence is demonstrated to us as he carries us faithfully along to that final destination. And it is so in the final ways. Dwelling in Goshen preserves us from being swallowed up into Egypt. Dwelling among the people of God as this distinct community, spending time with one another, keeps us from being absorbed and swallowed up by Egypt, by the world around us. It preserves us from being like Lot, like we've already seen, so surrounded and immersed in the world that his righteous soul was vexed without rest and without comfort. To dwell in Goshen among the people of God as his distinct community keeps us from being in that same position where day after day our righteous souls are vexed by the evil that we immerse ourselves in by choice every day. Keeps us from adopting its worldview. Not only was Lot's righteous soul vexed, but he was so indistinguishable in his living from his community that they laugh him to scorn when he tells them they ought to flee the judgment to come. And his own daughters and brothers and or sons-in-law don't believe him. Dwelling in Goshen, dwelling together as the covenant people of God, as the covenant community, keeps us from adopting and absorbing the worldview of a fallen culture all around us. Beyond that, dwelling in Goshen preserves us by providing us with a chief means to apprehend the presence of God. It says there's something that we need to understand. I know by now I'm beating a dead horse when it comes to this topic, but it's something that we have to grasp. We need to understand the untold damage that we do to one another when we refuse to dwell in Goshen, because we rob each other of the apprehension of the presence of God. Because his presence is seen here, saints, with each and every one of you. And every time you gather, whether it's in the public worship of God or whether it's to enjoy each other's fellowship at the table in your homes, every time you are provided with the opportunity to see God's presence in the faces of your brothers and sisters who make up his covenant community. And when we refuse to do that, saints, then we are robbing one another of a chief means to apprehend that presence. We need to dwell in Goshen in order that we might provide the opportunity to provide for those particularly who struggle with that sense of God's presence, the opportunity to see it as he said it is seen. And dwelling in Goshen means so much more than just spending time together. Dwelling in Goshen means spending time together rightly, with the proper attitude and disposition and treatment of one another, seeing the way that God is sanctifying us to overcome our own natural tendency towards division and to enmity and to strife and to abuse of one another. The negative example of Corinth, right? Paul is decrying all of the abuses of what should have been a community of Goshen, but looked a whole lot more like a community of Egypt in their mistreatment of one another, of their divisions and their sectarian nature. I am of Paul, I am of Apollos. Right? The rich bringing all of this feast while ignoring the poor among them. They were dwelling in Goshen, but not really. We see God's presence as he sanctifies his people to leave off the old man, wrapped up in malice and slander and favoritism and all of those things, and to put on the new man, kindness, tenderheartedness, forgiveness. Dwelling in Goshen means using our time together to speak to one another of his mighty acts. Don't miss how important that is, saints. It's all the way back to the beginning of the sermon. Where is God's presence seen? It's seen in what he does. But if we never talk about what he does, how will we ever see it, saints? We use our time together to speak to one another of his provision, of his preservation. Dwelling in Goshen isn't supposed to look like dwelling in Egypt, focused on merely the earthly temporal enjoyments of life. It's not to say that you can't do that, but it's not just about that. It's not only about that. But rather, we should be speaking of his provision and his preservation one another, of his goodness and his faithfulness and his mercy on display in our lives each and every day. We see that in our worship as we sing of God's mighty acts and his covenant faithfulness, as we hear him speak of that in his word and speaking with one another about it in our observation of the sacraments that he's given to us as those signs and seals of his presence. And beyond that, in our fellowship, this is the feast, but saints, we need snacks to preserve us to the next meal. And when we come together as the people of God in our little fellowships, right? How often is there the open declaration of our struggles and our victories? Think of it in these terms as we interact. Think about asking one another as you come together, how has God demonstrated his presence to you this week? How has he provided for you? How has he preserved you? It's great to talk about all of the doctrinal controversies in the world and all of the doctrinal concepts. That's fine. But don't forget the practical realities of life. How is God's presence working in your life? And oh, by the way, here's how it's working in mine. So that dwelling together in Goshen as the people of God, seeing his presence through what he does with one another, we can stand just as the Israelites of old were to stand, just as Jacob was to stand, without fear, but with courage, trusting in God's promise of his presence, seen in his provision and his preservation of his people, courageously live and pursue the life of faith until the days of our sojourn are over and we come to that final promised land. Let's pray together. Our Heavenly Father, we are thankful that you have given us the promise of your presence, and that your presence is seen in the things that you do, in the way in which you provide for us, in all of the ways in which we need provision, in the ways in which you preserve us, the church at large, through all of these many centuries, from the threats without and the threats within, yet still it has grown and still it is here because of your preserving presence and hand, and in each one of us as well. Still we are here. Still we are striving. Still we are living together in pursuit of the same promise, living the same life because of your preserving presence. Father, fill us with a sense of it. Give us the ability to look and to see and to apprehend your presence among us through your Spirit, so that indeed we might courageously and boldly live the life of faith, trusting your promise, trusting in your presence. We ask these things in Jesus' name. Amen.